open the discredited Yucca Mountain White Elephant Nuclear Waste Repository, and poof! The problems of long-term storage of high-level nuclear reactor waste is solved. But then, when you hear of yet another problem nobody bothered to anticipate, should Yucca Mountain ever open?
Because the rock is with water inside, when they would implant the waste, it would crack the rock. The water would be pushed away from the canisters for a period of time until the canisters cool. Then the water would go back to the canisters, corrode the canisters. Radiation, once the canisters are breached, would be released into the aquifer.
And so many other problems. When you hear things like that, you know you are in the seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with Ian Zabarte of the Western Shoshone Nation. Nuclear tests on his tribe's sacred ancestral lands, and the sighting of Yucca Mountain in that area. And more on Westlake Landfill and its illegally buried World War II nuclear weapons waste, as Alex Cohen of the Earth Defense Coalition fills us in on yesterday's nonviolent activist takeover of Missouri Representative Lacey Clay's office. The goal? Forcing Representative Clay to make good on his promise to set a date for introducing federal legislation that would give control of the Westlake Landfill's radioactive waste cleanup to the Army Corps of Engineers instead of the EPA. Did it work? Keep listening to find out. Plus, we will have Numbnuts of the Week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, the nuclear reactor duck, and cover report based on the latest problems with our crumbling U.S. nuclear reactors, plus news, attitude, and more honest nuclear information than even Dan Rather's News and Guts on Facebook is reporting. All of this coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, May 23rd, 2017, and here is the week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S., the nuclear waste management infrastructure has been falling apart at the seams, with the second accident in 10 days at Hanford and a new one at Idaho National Laboratory. A double-sided underground storage tank for hot, boiling, radioactive, and chemically contaminated waste was undergoing routine testing when a radiation specialist on the crew detected higher-than-expected radiation readings. Radiological monitoring showed contamination on the unit that was 3 times the planned limit, and contamination was found on one worker's clothing in 3 spots, shoe, shirt, and knee area. No one was wearing hazmat gear because no contamination was expected to be found. The underground tank holds up to 800,000 gallons of highly toxic and radioactive waste, and finding radiation means that there was a possible leak. The tank was put into service in 1976 with a life expectancy of 20 years. It has now been holding this waste for 41 years. Of Hanford's 28 double shell walls, this is the second that has been known to have the inner shell show signs of failing. This contamination event comes just 10 days after a tunnel collapse at Hanford that caused a site-wide emergency. On May 9, workers found a 20-by-20-foot cave-in of a tunnel used to store highly radioactive and chemically contaminated equipment from the Cold War era. Now, according to investigative reports by Susanna Frame of King 5 News in Seattle, For nearly 40 years, Hanford's own experts have been raising red flags about the tunnel that collapsed. Scientists hired by the U.S. Department of Energy began a series of warnings about the possible failure of Hanford's Purex tunnels nearly four decades ago. In 1980, Department of Energy expert G.R. Sylvan wrote, "If the contents of the tunnel must be removed, it should be deactivated as soon as possible to ensure the tunnel is still structurally sound during the removal operation." The tunnel was constructed of creosote-soaked railroad ties, which are known to disintegrate under the force of gamma radiation, such as was coming from the equipment. It was conservatively estimated at that time that the strength of the timbers would be at only 60% of original strength by the year 2001, and now it's 16 years later. While there was a call for reevaluation in 2001, King 5 has found no documentation that the reevaluation ever took place. So how is Hanford dealing with this site? They dumped 53 dump trucks of dirt on top of it, dirt which does not mitigate radiation, and have since put a plastic tarp on top that's being anchored with concrete blocks. Admittedly, the concrete blocks all weigh over 3,000 pounds, but it's not unlike the way that I protect my compost heap. And this is a lot worse than compost. And speaking of nuclear infrastructure collapse, on Thursday, March 11, at the Idaho National Laboratories near Idaho Falls, Idaho, an excavator was digging up transuranic waste, that's nuclear waste, that was stored in underground containers when the ground collapsed beneath it. The pit is about 21 feet deep, and the operator was forced to remain inside his protective cab for about 90 minutes until crews worked to make sure that it was safe for him to leave. Interestingly, the site was safer than at Hanford because the nearly 2-acre dig site is completely enclosed in a soft-sided building designed to contain any radioactive debris, and workers inside the building were wearing protective gear. The excavator operator, in addition, was in a protected cab with a personal air supply. That's probably why, according to last week's guest from Nuclear Care Partners, there are fewer claims made for damage from nuclear exposure at Idaho National Laboratories than at Hanford. Duck! And cover report. The problems at the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station continue to reveal themselves, with issues ranging from failure to comply with federal requirements for reporting incidents to lack of a long-term solution for disintegrating panels with the job of preventing a nuclear reaction from occurring in the spent fuel pool. As David Lockbaum, head of the Nuclear Safety Program for the Union of Concerned Scientists, said, "If Pilgrim were a horse, it would have been shot and put down by now." Just one example. The 3,000 radioactive spent fuel rods, stored on racks and submerged between 20 feet of water, are separated by Boraflex panels, which contain boron. The minimum critical volume necessary to sustain a nuclear chain reaction may be as small as 4 fuel assemblies, and an assembly consists of 200 or more fuel rods. This according to NRC spokesman Neil Sheehan. Entergy, owner of Pilgrim, notified the commission in July that 534 Boraflex panels in the pool were deteriorating. By December, further testing showed 885 panels would be in danger of deteriorating by September 2017. But the 45-year-old nuclear reactor is slated to stay open for nearly 2 years beyond that date. Madness! Other duck and cover reports of problems at nuclear reactors, LaSalle in Illinois, Vogtle in Georgia, St. Lucie in Florida, and Quad Cities in Illinois all had problems that were reportable to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of week.
The University of Arkansas has begun disposing of wastewater from the C4 nuclear plant into the Fayette City sewer system. Now, the water was tested by an outside laboratory, and the Arkansas Department of Health deemed it to be within the safe limits for radioactive materials. But let's unpack that statement, shall we? The C4 is a deactivated experimental fast breeder reactor. It operated only from 1969 to 1972 and was then acquired by the University of Arkansas in hopes that it could be used as a research facility. However, that never happened, and the university has been paying $50,000 a year in maintenance fees because C4 is still considered contaminated, and the university continues to seek federal funds to clean up the site to no avail. That's $2.25 million that they have spent on something that is not only worthless, it's an albatross. The wastewater was transported from C4 to Baum Stadium, where it was pumped through a manhole into the sewer system. The water will flow into a water treatment plant and eventually into Beaver Lake, the main source of drinking water in the area. But the Arkansas Department of Health's Radiological Materials Program assures us that the water tested 2.5 times below the limit for radioactive materials. But what is that limit? How many rads? They're not listed in the article, so let me explain. The EPA limit for the safe, quote-unquote, amount of radiation in drinking water, and really the answer is zero is the only safe amount, but the EPA limit used to be 3 picocuries per liter. However, during the Obama administration, the EPA raised the allowable radiation in drinking water by 27,000 times. They will now allow a concentration of up to 81,000 picocuries per liter. So if the Arkansas Department of Health's Radiological Materials Program says that the water tested 2.5 times below the limit for radioactive materials, that's still 48,600 picocuries per liter. But wait, there's more. The Department of Health and Beaver Water District say the dilution, remember that word, dilution of the water throughout the various systems and the already low level of radiation make the water safe for people to drink. As regular listeners to the show understand, radiation does not dilute. It disperses. If something dilutes, it becomes weaker. And radiation never becomes weaker. According to Dr. Helen Caldicott, the cancer cycle is initiated by a single mutation in a single regulatory gene in a single cell in the human body. This mutation can be caused by a single exposure to a single atom of a radioactive element. There is no such thing as a little radiation exposure. It's all dangerous and it's cumulative. And if it's in the water, people are taking it inside, so it's internal contamination versus external. That little nuclear bugger is up close and personal with your internal organs, which is not where you want it. And that is why University of Arkansas, Arkansas Department of Health's Radiological Materials Program, and as ever, the International Atomic Energy Agency, you are all cumulatively this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out a week.
Thanks to listener Tom Prettyman for sending me that story. Two links to look for on the website. Harvey Wasserman has written an open letter to Jeff Bezos about Ohio's dead nukes. And Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! Interviewed Citizen Oversight head Ray Lutz about plans to sue to block plans to bury 3.6 million pounds of nuclear waste at San Onofre, only 100 feet from the Pacific Ocean. In Japan, Kansai Electric Power Company's Takahama No. 4 reactor was restarted on Wednesday, May 17, bringing to 4 the number of reactors currently operating in Japan. Anti-nuclear activists in neighboring Shiga filed a temporary injunction to halt the restarts of the Takahama No. 3 and 4 reactors, saying that safety standards were inadequate. In a landmark decision, the Otsu District Court agreed with the plaintiffs and ordered that the reactors be kept offline. But after KEPCO appealed, the Osaka High Court reversed the decision in March of this year, saying that the safety standards were not unreasonable. The ruling paved the way for last week's restart. And as part of the propaganda lead-up to the 2020 Tokyo Olympics, the radioactive Olympics, an international field of 144 male and 48 women surfers arrived in Japan on Tuesday, March 14, for the 2017 Ichinomiya Chiba Open. The Chiba waters are only 150 miles away from Fukushima Daiichi, and there are at least five major nations that refuse to import any fish caught off the shore of Chiba because of radiation concerns. Dude, if you think the fish is getting cooked by being in the radiation, what do you think's going to happen to you? Internationally, three related stories showing that people are turning away from nuclear. Swiss voters are supporting a referendum to withdraw the country from nuclear power in favor of renewable energy. A projection from Sunday's referendum shows a majority of cantons, which are states, voted for the plan. Under Switzerland's direct democracy system, initiatives need a majority of both cantons and votes to pass. And Swiss public television projects 58% of the voters in favor and 42% against the proposal. The Swiss government wants to ban the construction of new nuclear power plants and decommission the country's five existing ones at the end of their technically safe operating lives, which in Nuclear Hot Seat's opinion would be immediately. Opponents warned that the initiative would significantly increase electricity bills. I could live with that. In South Africa, a court has ruled that critical aspects of the country's nuclear procurement process are illegal and unconstitutional. The outcome is a significant setback for a network of entities that had been aggressively promoting nuclear expansion in the face of popular opposition. Over the past 4 weeks, controversy over the proposed nuclear build has reached new highs, sparked by a major cabinet reshuffle in which President Jacob Zuma ousted both his financial and energy ministers, replacing them with individuals regarded as pro-nuclear. The reshuffle prompted some of the largest and most diverse street protests since the dawn of the country's democracy in 1990. The court's ruling means, in effect, that the planners will have to go back to the drawing board. And 3 decades after the disastrous nuclear accident at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in Ukraine, the site is once again set to produce electricity, this time from solar panels. Business Insider reported that a small 1.5 megawatt solar installation could be completed by the end of May. China and Germany have invested in solar at Chernobyl. Driving Ukraine's desire to resurrect Chernobyl as an energy-producing site is the country's move to reduce its energy dependence on Russia. PV Magazine reports that Ukraine has 54 new solar projects in the pipeline. We'll have today's featured interviews in just a moment. But first, I know that you care about getting honest, verifiable nuclear news. Otherwise, you wouldn't be listening to this show. That's what we set out to provide at Nuclear Hot Seat. Verifiable information, sourced and checked every week. Plus, interviews with people who are genuine experts on various aspects of the nuclear industry and have information to share that the nuclear industry would prefer that you would not know. In order to do this, we do incur costs, and that's where we need your help. In order to continue to bring you the most accurate information possible, please help us out with a donation of any size. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the big red donate button, and know that I am deeply grateful for whatever you can do to help us meet our expenses and keep Nuclear Hot Seat alive and kicking serious nuclear butt. Last month, tribal representatives gathered at the University of Las Vegas for a Native American forum on nuclear issues. I wanted to go but was unable to attend this event to cover it. But I promised to get you information on what was discussed there, and I keep my promises to Nuclear Hot Seat listeners. Today's featured interview is with Ian Zabarte. He is director of the Nuclear Oversight Project of the Western Shoshone Nation. He's been working intensely on Yucca Mountain issues for many years and was a primary organizer of the forum. Here, he talks about not only the literal difficulties with the planned nuclear waste dump at Yucca Mountain, but also the spiritual meaning of the site to his people, both literal and metaphoric truths about the site, and how the U.S. government's dealings with the Western Shoshone people is just another incident of us not honoring treaty law.
Ian Zabarte, it's so good to have you as my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you. I enjoy being here.
You were one of the principal organizers of the April 22nd Native American Forum on Nuclear Issues, which was held at the University of Las Vegas. What was the intention of the conference? What were you hoping to achieve with it?
Well, our main goal was to have an event where Indigenous people can come and share among ourselves our stories and our experiences that really is the foundation for our continuing survival. So we come there to learn as stakeholders, as Indigenous community stakeholders, trying to understand what happened to us. So for the Marshall Islands, we're looking at what happened, what is happening to them with rising seas and the places where the U.S. conducted weapons testing, someday going to be underwater. And we look at what happened to Shoshone and Paiute, where the United States and the United Kingdom tested over 1,000 weapons of mass destruction, and what's happening to us and the impacts from that, which is essentially the fallout that went across North America. We also brought the Sioux from the Osage-Chicoan from Dakotas and Standing Rock to come and understand the fallout that fell from those same U.S. and United Kingdom tests on North Dakota and affected those people. You know, we also try to understand what are the other types of impacts, such as uranium mining, which is leaving tailings near tribal communities. We also look at things like fracking, for example. Fracking releases radiation, and most people don't understand that. It's naturally occurring radioactive materials. We look at coal mining and coal ash, which also is technologically enhanced naturally occurring radioactive material. So we're looking at the full nuclear chain, the types of radioactive materials, sources of risk and threat to our communities. And that's where we start. We use that as a way of looking far into the past and understanding how we used to live, the things that have changed, and ways we can mitigate those potential impacts and minimize the risk on our future generations.
Who were some of the speakers who were there representing the issues?
We had speakers from Dene, such as Leona Morgan with Hall No Campaign, working on uranium issues in the Southwest. We had Cleva Nolly, Dene also, working with Clean Up the Mines and also working out of Flagstaff on uranium mining in the Grand Canyon. So those are the feed materials that go into the nuclear chain. They are also concerned about the transportation of those materials that would then be turned into a yellow cake for use as part of the processing for use in weapons of mass destruction, as well as feed materials that go into production of fuel assemblies for nuclear power plants. On the rest of the cycle, we look at the use of those materials in reactors. So there's 115 nuclear reactors in 75 sites in 30 states, and those sites have gotten all the benefits from the generation and construction and the revenues from their investments. Whereas Indigenous people, we only deal with one side of it, such as our lands being used for extraction and torn up, and then our lands being used for the disposal, or at least proposed disposal of high-level nuclear waste, as well as the U.S. and U.K. detonating these weapons of mass destruction and essentially littering the continent with hotspots loaded with nuclear material. And we'd rather be investigating those things. Unfortunately, we're stuck dealing with the United States administration of disposal of high-level nuclear waste being proposed for our country. It's the most complicated and technical legal proceeding ever contemplated in human history. And unfortunately, we're stuck focusing on this administrative process rather than on the human health effects that really need to be investigated.
You are of the Western Shoshone people. You already mentioned that there were more than 1,000 detonations of nuclear devices, atmospheric detonations, on your land. Was there any kind of a protest or an attempt to block it that took place back in the 50s and 60s when this was happening.
Yeah, we've been actively engaged in trying to stop these activities. You know, we've come to the understanding that we cannot fight with governments, with the United States militarily. The United States is too aggressive. So we try to use peaceful methods, responsible methods that competent adults would expect. Unfortunately, the United States has reached a new low in human decency to the rest of the world, and people are starting to realize how we've been treated for hundreds of years. And the United States has come into our country, removed our people by gunpoint, so established the military-industrial complex here within the Shoshone Nation. They're not in the United States. They've developed their weapons of mass destruction in secret. When we begin to investigate the adverse health consequences we experience that are known to be plausible from exposure to radiation, the United States would deny us our right to investigate our own health. And this is what happened in the Yucca Mountain proceedings. The United States essentially said, because of our contention that in those proceedings on Yucca Mountain that stated that we bear a disproportionate burden of risk, and these studies that I'm talking about were based on the fallout. We reviewed the Department of Energy's offsite radioactive exposure review profile and found that based on lifestyle differences, diet, mobility, and shelter, so diet, what we ate, how we prepared our food, shelter, where our homes were, what they're made out of, and mobility, where we went and what we did there, we found our risk of exposure significantly greater than the non-Native American population in the same area because we ate different foods, we prepared them differently, and we ate, for example, in deer or rabbit, we ate the whole animal, and some parts of those animals received higher exposure than others, such as the thyroid. And we didn't know about these things. So, and the United States didn't investigate these things. Essentially, they're saying we don't have the right to talk about our health disparities because the Department of Energy knows better.
When you say health disparity, what are the known health consequences of these nuclear actions on your land, on your people?
There's a wide range. I was involved with the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act in the 80s, the Shoshone were, and I was the person principally attending those negotiations. And unfortunately, you know, lawyers want to be paid. And so after working 10 years without being paid, I've been working 30 years, but that's a different mindset, I believe, than these people who just want to make money. In this case, they were lawyers, and we only got 15 primary cancers. You know, there's some normal health consequences of various cancers, you know, thyroid, leukemias, but there's really a wide range of cancers which are associated with exposure and other types of illnesses, autoimmune deficiencies and you know, the physical and mental deformities, those kinds of things are well known, but not some of the autoimmune. And radiation is cumulative. What we're learning about radiation, you know, we can reference the National Cancer Institute's 1997 report on radioactive fallout from weapons testing, and we can look to the National Academy of Sciences' Biological Effects of Ionizing Radiation, which essentially says there's a no-threshold linear relationship between exposure to radiation and cancers that will be seen. So you get more radiation exposure, you're going to get more cancer. And that's the National Academy of Sciences. They specifically reject hormesis, that there's some kind of beneficial exposure to radiation. So we use that, and our understanding is that based on our past exposure to radiation in fallout from U.S. and U.K. testing of weapons of mass destruction, we can expect increased cancers from additional threats and hazards, such as transportation accidents or other potential releases from radiation. Even if the Trump administration tests another bomb, that's going to hurt us. So we need to take care of ourselves, be aware, and actually try to prevent those things from happening. Those are violations of international law, and those kinds of tests within our country violate the 1863 Treaty of Ruby Valley for the Western Shoshone, but violate all five treaties and the treaties of other nations as well when that fallout comes to their country.
So the U.S. continues to break its treaty agreements with Native people, which unfortunately comes as no surprise. Now, your work has centered around the Yucca Mountain High-Level Nuclear Waste Repository. which has been built on Western Shoshone land. First of all, what does Yucca Mountain, the mountain itself, mean to your people?
Yucca Mountain is the identity of our people in relation to a place. All land is sacred. There's some propaganda that says we're lost and wandering and we didn't know where we were and that we're dwindling and we're going away, and that just isn't the case. There's policies in the United States that discriminate, and it's upheld by these reservations, which are essentially U.S. federal protectorates.
Explain that a little bit more. Are these considered to be, by the United States government, U.S. government land? Are they recognized as being territories separate and distinct from the United States? And is there a point of contention about that?
Well, yeah, and that goes to really what Yucca Mountain is. Yucca Mountain is really what the people are. We understand the land in relation to place the Creator, up, as we say in our language, put us here and gave us instructions of how to live in relation to the land. So when we're out on the land, when we're at Yucca Mountain, all of our mountains, all of our valleys have stories that inform us about how we're supposed to live. Yucca Mountain is no different. It's a serpent swimming west, and we're told that if you don't live in the right way, the serpent will release its poison. Now, it's kind of strange because, you know, these are stories we heard before Yucca Mountain was being proposed. And when we look across the valley from Yucca Mountain, there's a mountain range called Bear Mountain, and there's a similar story. There was at one time a lush forest there, and the people weren't living right, and the Creator destroyed the mountain and made it bare, and there's petrified wood from long ago that informs our living today. So we look at that as vision, looking far into the past and using that to inform our vision for the future. The land is our storybook, and when you tear pages out of somebody's storybook, like the Department of Energy does to our living lifeways, you become a little lost or unable to be everything you're supposed to be. So I think that's really what this concept, but we were not wandering. We knew where we were. We have the instructions of how to live, and we still try to live those ways. It's being made increasingly impossible to live because the United States is assaulting our people on and on and on.
What is the nature of the current research that you are involved in with Yucca Mountain?
More recently, we've been looking at water because the Yucca Mountain site is in the biosphere. It is about 400 feet above the water table. The original intent of deep geologic disposal of high-level nuclear waste was sub-seabed or below the water table. At Yucca Mountain, it is in the biosphere, and the concern is that during the normal heating and cooling of the planet, which happens on average between 7 and 15,000 years as the Earth oscillates closer and further away from the sun, water will, in these wetter periods, rise up into the repository horizon, corroding the canisters and taking the nuclear material out and down into our groundwater. And what's really misunderstood about the West, people come out here and they look around and they don't really see anything. They see a desert and they say there's nothing here. We have as much biodiversity as a rainforest. From our little bugs to our mountain lions, we have some of the oldest life on the planet, the bristlecone pine. These trees are up to and over 5,000 years old. We have the western white pine, which is 1,000 or more years old. So we look at things more in a geologic sense, in a geologic term, and we have a responsibility to protect those other life forms from our foolishness. So when we look at the repository and we look at the water, we have pristine water. Pristine water. You really can't get that anywhere else. Our water is in the ground, but it's not well understood and it's not well known. And people think that, oh, you know, there's nothing out here. Well, they don't have pristine water in other places. Also, the water has a medicine in it, if I can say that. And like everything else, these things need to be guarded and protected and used responsibly.
My understanding is that among the problems at Yucca Mountain is that since it was sited, it's been discovered that there are earthquake faults either beneath the spot or very close to it, that the ground is actually porous, and that in addition to the flooding, the geological flooding you mentioned over eons coming up, that there could also be, if there is any kind of leakage, it could sink down into the aquifer and contaminate it that way.
Yeah, it's not a good spot. And like I was trying to convey, there are about 115 reactors at 75 sites. Some have multiple reactors in 30 states. And each of the states and communities that host those reactors have gotten the funds from building those reactors, billion-dollar projects. They've gotten the jobs. They've been able to invest in those companies. They've gotten the electricity. And we're expected to bear the burden of risk posed by the waste from all of those reactors. We would not get all those benefits. We would just get the waste. And that is what we consider environmental racism. It's not fair. You know, when you're walking on Yucca Mountain, and if anybody would like to go there, I'll certainly take them. It's like walking on glass, the welded tuff. It sounds great, welded tuff. It's fractured rock. The entire place, it looks dry. There's cactus around, and it looks like there's nothing there. But when you look into the rock, in the pores of the rock, the mountain is 10% saturated with water inside the pores of the rock. So the Department of Energy did a heater test. They put a heating blanket and heated a pillar of rock inside the mountain to 400 degrees for a period of a couple of years. During that time, the rock released the water, and it was raining inside the test alcove. Gives you a sense of how much water is in there. And because the rock is with water inside, when they would implant the waste, it would crack the rock. The water would be pushed away from the canisters for a period of time until the canisters cool. Then the water would go back to the canisters, corrode the canisters. Because it's in the biosphere above the water table, that radiation, once the canisters are breached, would be released into the aquifer. And it'd come out in the normal places that it usually does every 7,000 to 15,000 years with the upwelling and percolating down of water throughout the repository. Now, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission staff in 2015, I believe, issued a report requiring the Department of Energy or the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to complete a supplement to the final environmental impact statement for Yucca Mountain, which included that release of radiation. So that's what we've been working on lately. And we're really, you know, looking at how is that going to impact the water that we as indigenous people use. And it's really threatening the fundamental basis and identity of who we are if we're not able to have that pure water. We use it for healing. We use it for living. We use it for basic things. But we have to really have that pure water in order to maintain our identity as a distinct people. We are all from the water.
And water is life, as we heard so repeatedly on the Dakota Access Pipeline protest.
Water is life.
So given the conference and the coming together of activists there with your shared issues, what are the next steps? What actions are being taken by the indigenous populations, and what can we as listeners to Nuclear Hot Seat do to support you in this work?
Well, we're trying to get the word out. You know, we're collaborating with other organizations. We just can't deal with each of these issues in isolation. We can't deal with the weapons of mass destruction or the proposed repository or uranium mining. We have to consider the whole chain and become competent on each of those waste streams, such as the technologically enhanced, naturally occurring radioactive material. People are getting cancer from coal ash, and they don't even know it. They don't even know it. The coal ash contains uranium. When they burn coal in a coal-fired power plant, it increases the concentration of the radiation. Radiation's coming up from fracking. It's in the ground. It's everywhere. And when they frack, they crack that. It comes up in the water spills. It comes up in the leaks. It comes up in the brine spills. And these truckers in some areas are just driving down the roads with those valves open, letting out that radioactive material. We're trying to understand the full scope of potential impacts from nuclear technology, and we're working with our collaborators so that we can have effective voices and get out a message in every opportunity that we have. So we've had people from our conference going to the Permanent Forum on Indigenous People this week and last week. We also are preparing for the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty activities in June and July at the UN. So we're moving in those areas. We're also considering other opportunities for litigation. We have many opportunities. Unfortunately, we've been, as I mentioned, spending so much time working on Yucca Mountain. We're still in the proceedings as a party withstanding. We're just trying to be prepared for those proceedings when they take place. And part of those preparations are really understanding what the impacts are. The United States has already had action taken against it by the Organization of American States. We've already received an opinion from the United Nations Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, which filed a critical full decision against the United States federal Indian law and policies. That decision was issued as Decision 168, urging the United States to desist from all activities planned or conducted on Western Shoshone ancestral lands in relation to our resources, which are being carried out without consultation and despite the protests of the Shoshone people. We have a long history of resisting U.S. WMDs. We've had as many as 30,000 people protesting at the gates of the Nevada test site. And I personally issued about 20,000 permits to these individuals to be within Western Shoshone country. The United States cannot resist that because they see what the law says. The federal statute which created the territory of Nevada specifically forbids the inclusion of Indian country into the boundaries or jurisdiction of Nevada. And we issue our permits to our friends and supporters to gather and go and come within our country, and the United States hasn't done anything. People were not arrested. They were detained shortly and returned back. We will be challenging the state and the federal authority in our country through the court system. We, unfortunately, are dealing with this Yucca Mountain issue on and on and on. The United States cannot prove ownership, and that's where we stand on the issue right now.
So getting back to how listeners to Nuclear Hot Seat can support you in your work, what actions can we take that will be supportive?
We have a couple of websites. One is the nativecommunityactioncouncil.org. That's all one word, nativecommunityactioncouncil.org. And we're trying to prepare ourselves for the Atomic Safety Licensing Board. People can provide support through our website, or they can provide support to one of our other organizations, such as Puaba, which is our healing center in Tecopa. And really, that's the soul of the people is in that water. That's why it's so important for us to protect the waters. Puaba.org, Puohabah.org. That's Puaba, which means power water. And that's why we're really focused at this time on the water. And it seems to be appropriate because the releases that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission suggests will come from Yucca Mountain will go right down to our healing center at Tecopa, California, and go then from there to our other community in Death Valley. When the Nuclear Regulatory Commission did their analysis on this discharge of radiation from the proposed repository, they completely omitted any reference to Western Shoshone or to our communities or to our treaty. And I think that's one of the things that's missing throughout the entire Department of Energy's Yucca Mountain project. They did not mention the treaty. They deny any argument that would not support licensing of Yucca Mountain, such as the treaty's in full force and effect, and they can't prove ownership, so they just won't talk about that. They've relied on litigation rather than to take responsibility to protect human health and the environment, and actually have lowered the health standards by ignoring the fact that there's Native Americans that have different vulnerabilities, and we think that's environmental racism. They need to be more active and engaged in protecting human health and the environment instead of destroying life and preparing to destroy life on the planet. President Obama was keep hope alive. My banner these days is keep humanity alive.
From your mouth to whoever's in power's ears, in Zabarte, you're doing terrific work, and please keep us informed. And until we next speak, thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Ian Zabarte, Director of the Nuclear Oversight Project of the Western Shoshone Nation. We have a video on the Western Shoshone understanding of Yucca Mountain featuring Ian, entitled Yucca Mountain, Serpent Swimming Westward. You can find it on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 309. And you can learn more about the issues that Ian discussed at the websites nativecommunityactioncouncil.org and pooba.org. Links will be up on the website. Activist shout out. Alex Cohen is an activist who believes in direct, often dramatic, action. He's one of the founders of the Earth Defense Coalition and was one of the organizers behind the recent Westlake Landfill Nonviolent Civil Disobedience, a.k.a. protests. Westlake is the site of over 70,000 tons of illegally buried, highly radioactive nuclear waste left over from World War II's Manhattan Project. It sits within 600 feet of an unstoppable, now four-year-old fire at the adjacent Bridgeton landfill. When public officials aren't doing enough to stop or mitigate this ongoing, ever-worsening approach to a real disaster in the Midwest, it's time for more drastic measures, and that's what Ian and the Earth Defense Coalition provides. In the past, he and other activists have chained themselves to 500-pound blocks of cement left in the pathway of massive trucks at Republic Services, the company that owns the Westlake landfill. He did this just to make people aware of the nuclear disaster in North St. Louis, and the media did respond. It was good video. It was also a great message, but hey, mainstream media, they were going after the great visuals. In any event, yesterday, Monday, May 22nd, Alex and members of the Earth Defense Coalition took over and occupied the office of Missouri Representative Lacey Clay for over 4.5 hours. This was intended to push for introduction of federal legislation to have the Army Corps of Engineers FUSRAP program take over remediation of the Westlake site. When I called Alex to find out how it was going, I jumped right in with the obvious question.
Are you in custody? Are you out of custody? Where are you right now?
Out of custody. No one actually got arrested this time.
Tell us about the action you took and your reasons for taking it.
At the end of last month, at a town hall meeting, Lacey Clay looked myself and many others in the eye and said that we could expect federal legislation at the beginning of May to clean up the Westlake landfill. And here we are past May 20th. And so we took action where we went into his office and three activists chained themselves together with a lockbox, and about 20 people joined them, and we set up tables. We handed out radioactive cups with water in it, like with radioactive symbols on the cups.
But it wasn't radioactive water, was it? It's just symbolic. You weren't poisoning anybody.
No.
Okay, so how did this play out? How did you get in? What did it take to set this up? And what was the response when they realized what was happening?
Well, at first, it seemed that they had noticed us, and the door was actually locked. And so it took someone that looked like they weren't associated with us to knock on the door to get them to open it, at which point then we all rushed in and took the office over.
Was this the door to the entire office? Was it an inside office within a larger complex?
It was the door from the street directly into the representative's office.
What happened once you rushed in? You locked yourselves together in a way that you could not be easily extricated?
Yeah, so three activists locked themselves inside of lockboxes to each other, and then we began setting up tables and decorating the office with radiation signs and signs with our demands on it, and set up even a kid area for all the kids that were with us in the office. And we started kind of taking it over and just making it ours and let them know that we were there until legislation was introduced to clean up Westlake Landfill.
What was the response of the people in the office?
Well, at first they were trying to save face So it was a long negotiation process. It was 4.5 hours. First, they were, you know, the political process is hard. It's not that easy. And they wouldn't give us really any solid answer about legislation being introduced.
I saw a copy of a tweet from Representative Lacey Clay saying that he was planning to introduce the legislation on Wednesday. Was that in place, do you believe, before your action, or do you think you speeded up the timeline on it?
I don't know. It's hard to say because originally, at the beginning of the occupation, he wouldn't give us a date, and he wouldn't do that. And so we demanded that drafted legislation be sent to us, at which point the legislative assistant sent in drafted legislation for the Army Corps of Engineers to take over at the site. And then we started asking for it to be made public, so that way there was a public commitment to the date Wednesday that he had told us, at which point he then tweeted out that it was happening on Wednesday.
Were you one of the people who was in the lockbox?
I was not actually in the lockbox. There were three people, local residents and constituents of Lacey Clay, that were locked down. And then about 20 to 25 of us, including myself, were in the office occupying the space next to them.
Once you learned that he had tweeted out that this legislation was going to be introduced on Wednesday, how did things roll from that point on?
We all got together and we talked about, you know, where we wanted to go from there. And everyone was pretty much in agreement that we came in and we said, well, we're not going to leave until either legislation is introduced or we get drafted legislation in our hands and a public promise of that legislation. And that's exactly what happened. And I've been a part of a lot of occupations. And I'll tell you, it usually, you know, it's like either this happens or we're here until we get arrested. And usually we always get arrested. So this is one of the more successful occupations I've ever been a part of.
I would ask you what your next move is if on Wednesday there is no introduction of the legislation for whatever reason. But that might be giving away anti-nuclear state secrets. Would you agree?
Yes, but I will say, and we let the representative know that we are ready and prepared to hold him accountable to Wednesday.
My sense of fear rejoices in this action you have taken, and may it be successful as the start of a process for some real compensation and some justice for the residents around the Westlake landfill.
Thank you. Yes, we definitely hope so indeed, and we are ready to hold him to his word.
I can't even imagine what that would look like. Alex Cohen, you can follow the work of this highly imaginative activist action group at earthdefensecoalition.com or under Earth Defense Coalition on Facebook. And an activist shout out to German anti-nuclear activist Hannah Pottig. She went to prison at Hildenheim on May 11th in order to serve her sentence of up to 110 days in imprisonment. 5 years ago, on June 30th of 2012, Hannah and another protester joined their arms together inside a metal tube that was chained to a railroad track. They were able to stop a trainload of diluted uranium waste coming from the uranium enrichment facility of Grenoble, destined for the nuclear reprocessing plant of Pierrelatte in France. Hannah chose imprisonment over paying a fine of 1,650 euros, a little over $1,800 U.S., so as to make the case more visible through her imprisonment. The other activist, Cecile Lecomte, was also sentenced for blocking a nuclear train, but local prison director Oliver Wessels paid the fine from his own pocket to avoid further public attention. That's pretty desperate. Hannah is looking forward to receiving letters and postcards of solidarity. She expects to be released after about 4 weeks of imprisonment, as activist groups already have started collecting donations to spare her some of the 110 days in prison, if possible. Meanwhile, if you want to send her a postcard, her address will be posted up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, episode 309, and a postcard to Germany from the United States costs only $1.15. Let's keep those cards and letters rolling. Here's today's final thought. When it comes to all things nuclear, everything old is new again, and that's getting really old. Sometimes it feels toxic just to read the posts on my Facebook feed, which operates a lot like a news service for nuclear issues. But the repetition is getting to me. All nuclear is all numbnuts all the time. The infrastructure keeping the waste even minimally at bay is crumbling. The nuclear industry will lie to cover its hindquarters and continue to grab as much money as it can without considering people or the environment. And those who take an activist stance against it are among the bravest, strongest, smartest, and most compassionate women and men on the planet. Sometimes it feels like I say those things in one form or another every week. I did it this week. I'll do it next week. So be it. Nuclear Groundhog Day. Here's hoping we get to wake up from it soon. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, May 23rd, 2017. Material for this week's program has been researched and compiled from the top three women in mainstream media presenting nuclear news: King 5 NBC in Seattle and their ace reporter, Susanna Frame; TriCitiesHerald.com and their ace Hanford reporter, Annette Carey; Cape Cod Times and their ace Pilgrim reporter, Christine Legere. Great job, ladies. Thanks for keeping us informed. Also serving as sources for this week's show are DenverPost.com, Third Way, Democracy Now!, Progressive.org, JapanTimes.co.jp, WorldSurfLeague.com, Dianuke.org, ABCNews.go.com, NSNBC.me, Enviro News.tv, TheEcologist.org, IanFairley.org, the psycho-nuclear apologists who sold their souls for the paycheck they get for writing press releases for World Nuclear News, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission event reports, thanks to Erica Gray of Nuclear Free Virginia and the Virginia Sierra Club, and a shout-out to the Nuclear Hot Seat listeners and followers, big-hearted planet protectors and peaceful warriors all, who gather at the Nuclear Hot Seat blog site on Facebook. You know, only 31 more likes and we will hit 2,000 on the Nuclear Hot Seat blog page. That's the one with the logo on it. So come on down and let's click that like button. You join, you share our posts with people you really care about, and you also get to send them to any pro-nukers in your life as well. They may just delete them, but at least you gave them the chance to know the truth. Not the alt-truth, not a version of the truth, the truth. Nuclear Hot Seat theme music written by me, sung by Marilee Weber, accompaniment by John Barnard, recorded at Winslow Court Studio in Hollywood. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. We are copyright 2017, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. And proper attribution consists of the show, my name, and the website or link. A reminder that if you appreciate weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world, delivered with as much humor as possible, take a moment to send a supporting donation to nuclearhotseat.com. This is Libby Halevi of Heartistry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that out of sight is not out of mind or out of danger when it comes to nuclear waste. So see, you've all had your nuclear wake-up call. Now do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's da bomb.
Zion 1080 Radio.